This is special coverage from WBUR in Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. After the weekend's suicide bombing attacks, Prime Minister Ariel Sharon is painting the Palestinian terrorists and leaders with the same brushstroke President Bush used for Al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden. But as Israel adopts the posture and prose of America, tonight's guest, Israeli journalist and author Tom Segev, warns America about the costs of returning the favor. In this hour, Israel's model of endless conflict and America's tough choices. First, the latest news from Israel. Earlier, I spoke with Jeff Barak, editor-in-chief of the Jerusalem Post. I asked him about fallout from the airstrikes, the mood in Israel, and if Yasser Arafat himself is a target.
Yasser Arafat wasn't injured. I don't think he was specifically targeted, but I think the Israeli army was trying to send a message to Yasser Arafat, and that's that he is within Israel's range, and he shouldn't take things for granted.
Give us a sense of the tone of conversation in Israel today. What are the headlines? What's being said on TV, radio, in the pages of your own newspaper?
We're concentrating on the attacks on Gaza and on Ramallah. There's a sense that Israel is taking revenge for the suicide bombings in which 25 people were killed in the space of 12 hours in two separate bombings in Jerusalem and Haifa. And there's this very strong sense that the Israeli government wants to continue sending a message to Arafat. The attacks that we saw today are going to continue tomorrow.
And is there unity in the country around what you describe as revenge attacks? We heard dissent today from Shimon Peres.
I don't think Shimon Peres dissented in the sense that he felt that Israel shouldn't be attacking. He said that he didn't think Israel should topple Yasser Arafat or bring about the destruction of the Palestinian Authority. At the same time, I think he said that Israel does have to send a signal to the PA that unless it gets serious in a crackdown against terror, then it's going to suffer, it's going to pay the price. And I think really that is the general mood here in Israel, that the PA and Yasser Arafat have to be made to understand that there can be no countenance of terror. And if they're unable to do the job, well, Israel might have to do it itself.
Ariel Sharon appears to be echoing the language of Washington in describing the Palestinian Authority as a terrorist organization. Is this laying the groundwork for stepped-up attacks?
Well, yes, Ariel Sharon has been doing this for some time, accusing Yasser Arafat of being Israel's bin Laden and trying to use the bin Laden and the Taliban analogy wherever he possibly can. I don't think, though, the situation is the same. I don't expect to see carpet bombing of Palestinian areas in the same way that the United States and Great Britain have been carpet bombing Afghanistan. On the other hand, I do think that Israel is going to be putting some very, very heavy pressure on Yasser Arafat and the PA to try and come to grips with Palestinian terror.
And when you say the signal is that if Yasser Arafat can't handle the terrorists, that Israel will do it for him, does that also imply pushing Yasser Arafat aside somehow?
Well, I don't think Israel's going to come out and say it's looking to topple Yasser Arafat, but I think it will take actions, and these actions will continue, and that might force Yasser Arafat of his own initiative to leave the areas, or for the Palestinian people to tell him now's the time to step aside. And if that happens, I don't think Prime Minister Sharon will shed any tears.
What might a stepped-up attack look like? Let's say Arafat leaves the scene and Israel is punishing the terrorists or whatever that means exactly. How does this turn into some kind of war? What would that look like?
I think what we're going to see in the next few days is continued Israeli attacks, pinpoint attacks on particular buildings that have served Palestinian Authority security services. These are the organizations that should have been clamping down on Hamas and Islamic Jihad and have failed to do so. I think Israel will be targeting those buildings time after time.
There had been some response in the U.S. today that in targeting those buildings, Israel may actually take away the only means that the Palestinian Authority has of clamping down. Any resonance with that view in Israel?
No, not yet. At the moment, Israel feels that the arrest that Yasser Arafat made yesterday, he talked about 100 arrests. The people he's arrested are not the people that need to be arrested. There is a list of 100 or so people that both Israel and the Palestinians know that they're active in terror. These people don't seem to be touched in this wave of arrests.
We know, Jeff Barak, that you're not the government, but help us try and look through this policy to perceive what would the West Bank and Gaza look like after an aggressive Israeli offensive if it succeeded.
I don't think we're looking at a situation where Israel is looking to go back into West Bank and Gaza and to reoccupy it. That's not the aim.
So what is the goal then? What's on the other side of this?
The other side of this is to say, well, if the PA isn't going to do the work, then we're going to put pressure on the PA. And if that means that the PA falls for whatever reason, either internally or due to this pressure, then that's fine. And Israel will just expect the Palestinians to find another way of looking after themselves. If Yasser Arafat can't keep the agreements that he made with Israel going back to 1993, when he said if there were disagreements, he would not resort to terrorism. He's failed there. Over the past 8 years, we've seen nothing but terrorism. If he continues in this way, then there's really no point trying to make an agreement with him, and we might as well look for some other form of Palestinian leadership.
Would an effort by the Palestinian Authority to really clean out the terrorists lead to a civil war among the Palestinians?
I don't think so. There is a very strong element, Islamic element, inside Palestinian society. There is, I think, 25% belonging to Hamas, Islamic Jihad. But I don't think necessarily that that would lead to civil war. If there's a strong Palestinian leadership that says to the Palestinian people, look, we have the chance for a state and for our own independence, but we can only do this if we keep our agreements with Israel, then I think the majority on the Palestinian street will say, okay, well, let's do it.
The images that we see on television suggest that there's maybe widespread Palestinian opposition to accepting those agreements or support for the Intifada. The echo we hear in the States is that you just create more terrorists by wiping some out. Is there that continuing concern in Israel?
No, because I think the feeling here in Israel is that one has to make clear that terrorism does not pay, that one cannot receive diplomatic victories through the use of terror, that if one wants to become a part of the international community, if one wants a fully independent state, then that has to be done in the accepted way of negotiation and not violence.
And is there a sense in Israel now that there's a full green light from Washington to go ahead with this kind of tough policy?
There is a sense that Washington has allowed Israel to take the gloves off, that there isn't the overwhelming pressure that we've seen. If you compare past incidents over the past 14 months, whenever Israel has gone into over the green line into Palestinian-controlled areas, the State Department was very, very quick to condemn. This time around, it hasn't happened. And both President Bush and Secretary Powell have been very, very clear in saying they understand the need for Israel to act in its own perceived best interest and self-defense. So there is definitely a feeling here in Israel that Washington said, okay, guys, go for it.
So, Jeff Barak, what will you be looking for in the days ahead to signal whether this is going to spiral into something really bloody or come to some interim point?
I'd be expecting to be seeing signs from the Palestinian Authority, from Yasser Arafat himself, through the diplomatic channels saying, look, guys, we know what we have to do, we're going to do it, and here we've already started. And for the Palestinian Authority to start making pinpoint arrests of key Hamas and Islamic Jihad people, people that we know are actively involved in terror. If we see those kinds of signs, then I think we'll be seeing the Palestinian Authority knows what it has to do. Whether that will happen, though, I'm not so sure.
You sound doubtful.
Well, if one looks at the Palestinian Authority's past record, except for a brief period in 1996, when Yasser Arafat realized that he'd let the Hamas go too far in the bus bombings of that year, we really haven't seen a concerted Palestinian fight against terror.
This sounds like the continuing tough line from Israel is then more likely than not.
For the moment, yes.
Jeff Barak is the editor of the Jerusalem Post. He spoke to us from Jerusalem. What does Israel have to teach the United States about fighting a war on terrorism? In its own war on terrorism, can America avoid imitating the endless cycle of Israeli-Palestinian violence? And what on earth is going on there right now? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-TALK. That's 1-800-423-8255. Joining us now from New Jersey is Tom Segev. He's an acclaimed columnist for Israel's daily newspaper, the Haaretz. He's author of two terrific books, most recently, One Palestine Complete, Jews and Arabs Under the British Mandate, and earlier, The 7th Million, Israel and the Holocaust. He's teaching this fall at Rutgers University's Bildner Center for Study of Jewish Life. Good evening, Tom Segev.
Good evening to you.
Thanks very much for joining us tonight.
Okay.
Tom Segev, you've written very provocatively about parallels between the United States and Israel this fall. We know you came to the U.S. expecting to have a little break from all the turmoil in Israel, and the turmoil followed you here. We're hungry for that perspective tonight, but we've got to touch on what's going on in Israel right now. It's just unavoidable. We get the sense that Israel and the Palestinians are locked in what feels like some kind of battle to the death right now. Is that how you see it? Must peace always be a distant prospect here?
Well, I don't think that there is a chance for real peace at this time. I think that the conflict at this time cannot be solved, but I think that it can be managed in a better way. And I don't think that the cycle of violence is a very good way, obviously. I think that it is not enough to demand that Arafat arrest these people. If he could arrest them, if they could be arrested, Israel would arrest them. Terrorism could be prevented, Israel would prevent it. We have a much deeper problem here, and I think that one of the things we need to do is to let Arafat gain something from the peace process. He has to show to his people that they are gaining something from the peace process. It is not enough to punish Arafat. You also have to give him something that he can show to his people that some hope, some progress has been made. Otherwise, I really think that we are up to that very pessimistic situation Jeff Barak has described. I don't think that it is inevitable.
But the Israeli government right now hardly seems in the mood to be giving Yasser Arafat anything. There's more an apocalyptic feeling about the moment.
Right. The word mood is the right word, because this is the major danger of terrorism. Obviously, it costs the lives of people, and that's very tragic. But I think that the major danger of terrorism is that it creates a mood that takes us back in time to a point in time which I thought that many people had hoped that we have left behind us.
You've written so persuasively about this. Israel, not so long ago, moving into a post-Zionist period where they were a bit freer, they felt more open to compromise, they felt more like ordinary citizens of the world, and now they may be sliding back.
That's right. And that is what terrorism really does to people, not only to us, but also to the Palestinians. It takes us back in time into a mood, as you said, a mood of desperation, a mood of where we don't believe that anything can be done. And so we hit each other and we kill each other. And that's really what terrorism does. It prevents people from thinking rationally about alternatives. And as you said, we are in no mood to make concessions to Arafat. But I think that when people raise the question, can Arafat make peace, you should also ask the question, can Sharon make peace? I think that both of them can't make peace, but I still think that both of them can manage the conflict in a way that would reduce the violence and make life a little bit more livable than it is right now. Right now, the situation is very, very bad, obviously.
Well, right now, both sides are using very freely the word war. What does that mean?
It means nothing. We already have a war.
Mm-hmm.
War really means more terrorism and more hardship, I'm afraid, against the on the Palestinian civilian population. It means nothing to the Palestinians that Israel destroyed the helicopters of Yasser Arafat.
Mm-hmm.
He will buy a new one.
Mm-hmm.
That's no big deal. And eventually, we will. I'm afraid that we might do worse things than destroying his helicopters.
The missiles came rather close to Yasser Arafat himself today.
Well, I don't think that we have an interest to kill Yasser Arafat. By the way, Sharon in his career tried that a number of times, you know, in his previous careers as commander in Lebanon and so on. But I don't think that we have much to gain from killing Arafat. I think that I'm very much afraid that eventually we will strike against civilians. And
that will feel like war. Tom Segev, we have to take a quick break.
Okay.
We've got a lot to talk about with you tonight. We're so glad you're here. What can we learn from Israel's example in the war on terrorism? What should we emulate and what should we avoid? We're talking tonight with the acclaimed Israeli columnist and author Tom Segev, columnist for the Haaretz newspaper in Israel. You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to special coverage from WBUR in Boston. This is special coverage from WBUR in Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. Strong words today from the Palestinian Authority and Israel about airstrikes and escalating violence in the region. We begin with Saab Erekat, a senior Palestinian negotiator.
Sharon is seizing the opportunity. He's deceiving the Israelis, the whole world, you, President Bush. He's out there to destroy the peace process. He's out there to destroy Palestinian Authority. He's out there only silencing the moderate voices. President Arafat is an elected president by the Palestinian people. So it is the Palestinian Authority. It's an elected authority. Now it's a coup d'etat being carried out by the Sharon missiles and F-15s and F-16s. And I really urge President Bush and Prime Minister Blair to stop him before it's too late, because he's really pushing the Middle East region in its entirety to the abyss of darkness, extremism, violence, chaos, and counter-violence and bloodshed.
Hard language. That was senior Palestinian negotiator Saab Erekat. Now, here's what Ariel Mekel, spokesman for the Israeli government, had to say about Yasser Arafat's record and responsibility today.
You have to understand what this is all about. This is following 15 months of a terror campaign. We are going from one funeral to the other. 10 Israeli children were killed in the center of Jerusalem. It's a terror attack on our major cities. What do you expect us to do? To sit back and wait for the next suicide bomber or for the next strike? I mean, you know, it's okay. So you say we are hitting security buildings. Right, he's hitting Jewish children in the center of Jerusalem. What do you think is worse, actually?
That was Ariel Mekel, spokesman for the Israeli government. We're joined tonight by Tom Segev, author and journalist and a great observer of the Israeli scene this fall in the United States, watching the United States respond to a terrorist challenge. We're looking at the parallels and asking how far should they go. Can the United States fight its war on terrorism without getting trapped in the cycle of violence that plagues Israel and the Palestinians? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Tom Segev, you heard those two sound clips from the Palestinian and Israeli sides today. I mean, you talked about mood, and there it is. It's blood, terror, suicide, bombs, children. How do you get out of that? How does the word peace fit in there?
Well, it is, of course, very tragic that the spokesmen are Saab Erekat and Ariel Mekel. But again, that's what terrorism does to peoples. It brings out the extremist motions in us. It makes us very difficult, much more difficult for us to think rationally and remember what our real interests are. And it's just something that has to pass, and it usually does after, you know, sometimes only days, but usually weeks and months. We get back to our senses and we think again. Right now we feel our blood is boiling, and that's very natural. Jerusalem is a very small town, and everybody knows everybody else, and when 10 kids get killed on a Saturday night in downtown Jerusalem, then people feel as if everyone, every single one of us, has been hit. And this is, of course, one of the things that I found so similar about the American reaction when New York was attacked by the terrorists, the Twin Towers. This is a feeling that it's something that hits everybody.
Tom Segev, this fall, probably more than ever, Americans can relate to that kind of feeling of anguish and anger that Israelis have felt, that Palestinians have felt. Your column, looking at the parallels, looking at the similarities and the kind of Israeli feeling in the air in the United States this fall, was really fascinating. I wish you'd go right down the line and sort of tick off the things that you found familiar in the United States this fall as the U.S. grappled with terror.
Well, First of all, it's important to say, because some people tend to forget, that we are really talking about two different wars. The war Osama bin Laden is leading against the United States is not the war Yasser Arafat is leading against Israel.
Loud and clear.
Some
understood.
Some of the means are similar, but it's really different type of situation. Some of the reactions were very familiar to me. First of all, the feeling that we are being attacked because of what we are. It took some time before American columnists started to think maybe it's something connected to globalization or the spread of American culture or our support for American support for oppressive governments. But it took some time. The first reaction was, it's not because something we have done or mm-hmm. some circumstance, it's because of what we are.
This is familiar from Israel?
Very, very familiar in Israel, where mm-hmm. we say, well, they attack us because we are Jews.
Mm-hmm.
Not because we are Israelis who occupy their land, but because we are Jews. So that's very, very similar.
And if it's because of what you are, it's insoluble. I guess.
Right, right. That's a very tragic thing, of course. The other thing which is very similar both in America and in Israel is relating to past tragedies in history. You say in America we have survived Pearl Harbor, we will survive Bin Laden. In Israel, people very often say we have survived the Holocaust, we will survive the war, we will survive Yasser Arafat. So that's, I think... I don't know how American it is, but I think it's a very Jewish thing to relate to our history, to our tragic history, and mm-hmm. draw the lessons, some optimistic lesson. Basically, it's a lesson of optimism, of survival.
Of survival.
Being very much aware of the fact that we survive. But again, it is something that very often uses very, very exaggerated terms.
And maybe a kind of sense that there's no choice but to go into this battle and survive the other side. You also wrote about the welling up of religious expression.
I was amazed by the amount of religious feelings I found in the American reaction. For me, America is a country that separates religion from state, and here you had the ceremony in a cathedral in Washington where the head of state, the president, comes, and on both sides of the aisle, members of the military are standing, and he gives his major speech to the nation from a church. So I really found that very interesting, and the speeches themselves are, you know, God bless America mm-hmm. is the term, and of course in Israel where religion and state have not yet been separated. We do this all the time, and in fact, some of the speeches which I heard here could have been written in Israel.
So, and you've written about the news outlets' response to the attacks.
This is part of "United We Stand," and when you say "United We Stand," it means that this is a political system that operates without opposition in Israel. Almost no opposition in this country for weeks, almost no opposition, and of course no opposition from the press. The press supports the government as the press supports the government in Israel, usually in times of war. In this country, I think they went even further than we do in Israel. I think that Sharon could envy President Bush for the very, very obedient media you have. Not that you should, but I think that at least the media should raise some thoughts, mm-hmm. some doubts. Readers should know why the media supports the government. And at the beginning, that was not the case. Later, of course, mm-hmm. Other voices also came up. But at the beginning, it really was the media
wasn't
speaking
that way.
In one voice.
Mm. And finally, Tom Segev, you wrote about the response, the impulse to respond with bombing away terror that you've seen in both Israel and the United States.
This is the Israeli experience, you know, being very narrow-minded and Israeli. I look at America with Israeli eyes, and I'm thinking of Lebanon. And our experience in Lebanon tells us that terrorism cannot be bombed away. You have to deal with the causes of terrorism. And also policy making in Lebanon didn't work for us. And so our advice we give ourselves, I think, is not for me to give advice to anybody, but the advice we give ourselves, I think, mm-hmm. if we ever go to Lebanon again, our lesson would be get out as soon as you can, because these are countries which cannot be run from Tel Aviv or from wherever you try to run them.
Something to bear in mind in Afghanistan. We're talking with Tom Segev, columnist for the Israeli newspaper Haaretz and author of One Palestine Complete, Jews and Arabs Under the British Mandate. You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. What do you make of the Israeli model of fighting terrorism? Is it a success, a failure, something to copy or to avoid? You can join us at 1-800-423-TALK. Mark is on the line. Welcome, Mark.
Hi, thank you. I appreciate Mr. Segev's comments. I wanted to say that I think that in terms of the Israeli model, I think that it's to be avoided the same way it should be avoided in the American model of retaliating from violence with violence, that perpetuates the cycle. And it also, especially in terms of Israel being neighbors with the people that mm-hmm. are being victims of the violence and retaliation to the victims.
I guess that's a difference. Afghanistan is far away. On the other hand, our terrorists lived among us too.
Well, they lived among us. That's true. But that's not the response. That's not the response that would, I mean, by destroying Afghanistan, you don't resolve the conflict. The people that are here in America who are going to be bombing or potentially bombing the United States, that's not a solution.
Mark, thanks for your call. Tom Segev, let me put that to you. What about the role of violence here? You described the anger, and of course there is the threat. You've seen this up close for so long. Do you agree there's a time for striking out with force and a time to stop, or
usually force is a sign of helplessness. This is the way I would describe the attack on Yasser Arafat's helicopters. Mm-hmm. Obviously, you cannot sit back and do nothing. This is not in the nature of human beings to sit back and do nothing. So you do something, and you do something just in order to do something. Mm-hmm. But this is not solving the problem that causes terrorism. On the other hand, although I think that some of these the tension can be reduced, I think it's very important to realize that terrorism is something societies must learn to live with as a permanent factor of everyday life. This is what the Israeli experience shows. It is very painful, and it is very tragic, and it is sometimes unbearable, but it is a must of life, and I think that many countries have learned that. America is learning it. It's a very painful process, and you always have to remind yourself, not only is terrorism part of everyday life, the fight against terrorism is also a permanent factor, which is equally unpleasant. And then you have to ask yourself, what price do I pay for that fight? And there, of course, you the whole question of democracy and civil liberties come up. We in Israel have learned a lot from American democracy. Part of our Americanization consists in introducing civil liberties and principles and values which we take from this country. And,
but you've written, Tom Segev, that a reduction in civil liberties made Israel no safer, but only more oppressive.
That's right. And therefore, I think that it's very tragic for me to, it's very sad for me to follow the argument in this country about the introduction of means which we have introduced in Israel. We fortunately do not have the death penalty in Israel, but we have, for example, legalized torture of suspects. Mm-hmm. We have military tribunals. We have trials where the accused are not allowed to see evidence against them. We have administrative detention. All of these things are limitations on our democracy. And the problem with these things is that they are introduced very easily, but they're very difficult to get rid of. Mm. And so this is why I'm following this debate in America with some concern.
We're all feeling it at the moment, and yet there's a feeling that we have to do something. We have a long line of callers who want to join this conversation, Tom Segev. We're at 1-800-423-8255. Debbie is on the line. Welcome, Debbie. You're on the air.
Hi there. You were speaking briefly about the media, and I'd like to ask your guest what role he thinks the media plays in shaping our perception of what is happening in the Middle East.
Do you mean the American media, Debbie?
The American media and the European media as well.
How about that, Tom Segev? How accurately
does... The European media is very different from the American media. I think that for an Israeli who lives in the United States, the first astonishing thing is the amount. I mean, just the number of words or the minutes on television, or the amounts you hear about Israel and the Middle East, and you would think it's an internal question of America.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's
so there's a lot of coverage, but what about the accuracy of the picture that you get?
I think that it is it depends on the different news media, obviously, but I think that some news media are doing a very good reporting about Israel and about the Palestinians, and I think that if you read the New York Times, you are very well informed about things that are going on in the Middle East. Both
the
Israeli side and the Palestinian side, I think, are covered very well. The Israeli side is probably covered a little bit better than the Palestinian one. But
and Debbie asked about the distinction between U.S. media and European. How would you describe the difference in their coverage of Israel?
I think that the European media is much more ideologically inclined, and much of it is much more critical of Israel than especially in France, and it's all connected to internal ideological and political debates they have. This is not the case in America. I think the American media is much more professional than the European one, in the sense that it is less ideological.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Tom Segev, stand by. We want to get one more call in before our next break. Bob is on the line. Welcome, Bob. You're on the air.
Hello. I'd like to make three actually comments, questions.
Make them fast, Bob. We're coming up on a break.
All right. First of all, I think the U.S. would be greatly helped throughout the world if it took a more fairer stance with regard to the Palestinian-Israeli issue. For instance, this year, President Bush has met with Sharon three times, but he hasn't met with Arafat.
Okay, there's point one. Two?
Point two, I think what we have to realize is that the Arab countries around Israel are very unstable. They're being pushed towards extremism. They have to take postures, and the leaders of these countries that are pro-Western can hardly function from day to day. If the intifada continues, and if the Palestinian-Israeli issue is not settled.
Got it. Three, and we're coming up on the break. Three?
Three, I think it would be much better for Israelis themselves to start talking about withdrawing from the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, just like they did in Lebanon. Stop the settlements, do it themselves, and draw a line, protect Israel, but at the same time make sure the Palestinians have a homeland. It would be much easier for everybody to defend that position rather than the position that we're here now, that the occupied territories have been occupied for 34, 35 years, and the Palestinians say self-defense. And
Bob, we're going to have to get Tom Segev's response after the break, but thank you for your call. Tom Segev, hold those thoughts.
Okay.
We're talking about Israel and what kind of model it might or might not be for the United States in the U.S. war on terrorism. Is the United States at risk of falling into an Israeli-style cycle of endless strike and counterstrike? How can the U.S. avoid that trap? And what can we learn from Israel? We're at 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to special coverage from WBUR Boston.
From Boston.
This is special coverage from WBUR in Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We're talking this hour with Tom Segev, columnist for the Israeli newspaper Haaretz, author of One Palestine Complete, Jews and Arabs Under the British Mandate, and a very insightful observer of the Israeli and, this fall, U.S. situations. You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. Tom Segev, just before the break, we had a call from Bob, and he painted a formula that's not unfamiliar. You've heard it, I'm sure. He says the U.S. should be more fair between Israel and Palestinians. Be careful of disrupting the shaky Arab neighbors. Israel should simply withdraw from the West Bank one way or another, and that's the path to peace. Can it be anything like that simple?
I definitely agree that Israel should withdraw eventually from most of the occupied territories. I think that some of the settlements can be dismantled unilaterally, as Bob said. I agree with him. I think that the Zionist dream and the Israeli interest would not suffer at all if some of these very small, isolated settlements in Gaza and around Gaza would be dismantled, and that would perhaps give the Palestinians some hope for the future. This is really something we need to do, and this is what I mean when I say that the conflict can be managed in a better way.
What about the U.S. role in leading toward that? Do you think the U.S. has acted toward Israel and the Palestinians in such a way as to encourage that?
The U.S. moved from one extreme to the other. Under Clinton, it seemed as if there's nothing more important on the agenda than peace in the Middle East. Then Bush came and said, I don't really care for the Middle East, and pulled out. Now he is in again. I think that it is in the interest of Israel to encourage Palestinian statehood, and I therefore think that it's also a good move on part of the United States. By the way, for the first time, if Bob says that they should take a fair position, for the first time under Bush, the U.S. now favors the establishment of a Palestinian state, and I definitely think that it is in the interest of Israel to encourage that. Again, as a sign of hope for the Palestinians, some kind of future for the Palestinians, that at least some of them will realize what everybody outside the region realizes, and that is that terrorism is bad not only for Israel, terrorism is bad for the Palestinians themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that you can also describe Palestinian terrorism as a sign of helplessness. They have to do something, so they blow up kids. But of course, as long as Israeli kids are killed on a Saturday night in downtown Jerusalem, all this is on paper.
Mm-hmm.
All these are thoughts and.
But the emotions and losses are real.
I can share them with listeners of a Boston radio station, but it's really not something that leads us anywhere. And it is therefore in the interest of the Palestinians, not only of the Israelis, to reduce the terrorism.
There's nothing simple about it, and Americans are no more sympathetic to understanding that than this fall. Simon is on the line. Welcome, Simon. You're on the air.
Good evening, Tom, and thank you for taking my call.
My pleasure.
In the beginning of the show, your guest mentioned that Israel has to give the Palestinians something to Mr. Arafat will be able to show to his people as an achievement. My question was that if we consider that after the Oslo agreements, Israel gave the Palestinians, the Palestinian Authority, and most of the cities and towns where the vast majority, almost all of the Palestinians live, what else can Israel give to them? That will be considered as a Palestinian achievement.
Sufficient.
But Mr. Segev already answered this question. So my next question is this. Why should Israel or anybody else believe that if Israel withdraws from all the territories except for a couple of settlements, why, in this case, the Palestinians will be ready to stop the violence and start building their own state?
Simon, that is the bottom line question, isn't it? And thank you for your call. Let's put it to Tom Segev. This is what comes up again and again, Tom Segev. If
right,
all
right.
should be given, how can they have confidence that even that will bring peace?
I'm assuming that as many Palestinians as possible should realize that they gain something from the so-called peace process. I'm not talking about a final peace agreement at this point. I'm talking about interim agreements, about pragmatic solutions to concrete problems, about managing the conflict. And I think that we need to make more Palestinians realize that they gain something from the peace process. Unfortunately, and I think this was the major mistake not only Israel made, I think the whole world made that mistake, that we did not realize that most Palestinians have gained nothing from the peace process. In fact, since Oslo, the number of Israeli settlers on the occupied territories has been doubled. And
so is that what's fueling this violence, or is it a committed few fanatics, as sometimes portrayed, that's fueling the violence? Which is it?
It is a few fanatics who do the action, but it is a growing number of Palestinians who support these fanatics. And that is something we need to prevent. We really need to support those Palestinians who do not yet support the terrorists. We need to support those Palestinians who still support Arafat. And this is why we need to give Arafat something which he can show as some achievement, some gain, something that, because otherwise his own people will tell him the only way is terrorism. Mm-hmm. They say Israelis understand. They say exactly to him what many Israelis say. Many Israelis say the Arabs understand only the language of force and of violence. Mm-hmm. More and more Palestinians say the Israelis understand only the language of violence.
So that's exactly where we don't want to go. Tom Segev, let's get one more call in. Ali is on the line. Welcome, Ali.
Thank you very much for taking my call. Can you hear me, sir?
Yes, we can.
Okay. I quickly wanted to ask your guest that, in his opinion, are there any special interest groups, whether Israeli or the Arabs, that do not want to see the peace process, not solely for the peace process, but the financial gains for them, or possibly clinging on to the power, and by fueling this war and trying to get people more radicalized, they're basically staying in power and control.
We've got it. Ali, let's put it to Tom Segev.
No, I don't think it's that rational as financial interests. I think it's much more emotional. And while I do see in Israel some groups who do not support the peace process, I do not see among the Arabs that many Palestinians who do support the peace process as we have in Israel. We do not have a Peace Now movement among the Palestinians, which I think is very tragic.
Tom Segev, a final question, and we don't have much time, but you've written about the parallels you've seen between the Israel and America state this fall, but you're elusive about how the U.S. can avoid Israel's seemingly endless cycle of violence. Can it? How?
It can help us get the talks, get the situation moving again. I think that at least part of the reason why we have come to this is that President Bush refused at the beginning to have anything to deal with America.
And how can, the United
States deal with each other unless the U.S. government helps us? And I think that we need a deeper involvement of the president himself. Under Clinton, we had better times, Israelis and Palestinians. It didn't work at the end, and I think you can analyze why if we had more time. But still, we need the U.S. involvement. Both Palestinians and Israelis need the U.S. involvement.
Tom Segev, thank you very much for joining us this evening.
Thank you.
Tom Segev is author of One Palestine Complete, Jews and Arabs Under the British Mandate, and earlier, The 7th Million, Israel and the Holocaust. You can continue this conversation online. Go to WBUR.org and click on Special Coverage Forums. Before September 11th, the hip-hop group The Coup planned to release their new album, Party Music, with an album cover featuring the group's two members standing in front of a mock-up of an exploding World Trade Center. The group and the record company immediately pulled the album cover after the real-life tragedy in New York. Boots Riley is the leader of The Coup. In this radio diary, he talks about the controversial album cover and about trying to get out political messages through music during a time in which he believes the mainstream media is towing a patriotic government line.
Yeah, what's up? This is Boots Riley from the rap group The Coup out of Oakland, California. The original album cover for Party Music, we started in May of 2001. The idea behind it was that the World Trade Center symbolizes the dominant system of trade right now, which is capitalism. And much in the way that we've seen the White House blown up on many images in the past, movies, posters, things like that, you know, we decided to use the World Trade Center to symbolize the types of places that we thought the seat of power in the world really is. So we had a cover in which the World Trade Center was blowing up, but it was blowing up from a combination of Pam, our DJ, waving conductor's wands, and me pressing a button on a bass guitar tuner, which doubled as a detonator, as to make the metaphor that our music is destroying capitalism, which is what our music talks about.
Slap him up and shake him up and then you know. Set him up the floor and bait him with the dough. You can do it funk or do it disco. Yeah, disco.
I think that there was a lot of overreaction because we see images all the time of nuclear bombs blowing up, which in the past, as in Hiroshima, have killed, you know, so much more than we could even fathom. But I've seen plenty of album covers, and you probably still will see plenty of album covers with nuclear bombs blowing up. But we have no sympathy for those people, you know, because they're not within these borders. And not only are they not within these borders, to make it plain, it's mainly because they're not white.
I'm provocative and pro-docking and FBI operative who pro-section all the black man pounds and hand you a sentence that you can't pronounce. I'm also anti-narco, anti-vice, 911 monster, anti-Christ. They anti-social point M6P, because I'm anti the anti-nigger machine.
In no way do we support terrorist violence. We do in our music talk about revolutionary violence. When we talk about a revolutionary overthrow of the state, we're talking about hundreds of thousands, if not millions of people taking over the factories that they work in, the facilities and the plantations that they work at, and the violence that comes when the U.S. comes to kill everybody who does that. And that's very different than some sort of individual act done to make a statement. What we're talking about is peoples having control over their own lives, and those types of actions aren't things that take control over their own lives. When the bombing on September 11th happened, I wasn't shocked because I make it my job to learn about atrocities that are happening all over the world. And so I already knew about the World Court finding the United States guilty of killing 30,000 innocent civilians in Nicaragua to overthrow a democratically elected government. I already knew about their hand in killing 60,000 people in East Timor. So I was aware that these type of things go on all the time and that this is nothing new. The only new thing is that someone did it here. Because I've been going around saying things like this, the original slant that the media was taking with people that they might have called radical or progressive or whatever was that after September 11th, everybody's down with the government. And so I started making sure that I was making statements that told you I am not down with the government, I'm not down for war. This is a time when the movement can grow or get crushed, right? And I think that it's important that people know that people are still out here fighting. It encourages them to speak up also. You know, I make my music so that people that want to do something to change the world can feel included with other people that want to change the world, and that they can hear music that relates their problems back to them. So I want people to feel inspired to join an organization, to go to a demonstration, to do something to change the material conditions around them. Almost atmosphere music for the movement.
Boots Riley is the leader of the Oakland, California-based hip-hop group, The Coup. You can see the original album cover of The Coup's latest release on our website. Go to WBUR.org and click on Special Coverage. Send your radio diary submissions by email. The address is special@WBUR.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to Special Coverage from WBUR Boston.
In the belly of the beat, stand true to it. Since my whole street days in the blue Buick, niggas been fighting so long, seem like I'm used to it. Now what y'all know about how the cool do it. Truth fluid. Booth put the fuck to it. Ain't nothing to it.
This is WBUR.